it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Beats other topics. First up, in controversies and non-controversies, we're skipping controversies and non-controversies, and instead we're going to
highlight... that's a controversy!
We're going to highlight some of the best stuff from the first half of the year. We do this usually in July. We look back at the first half of the year. We pick out some things we really liked to keep an eye on for our best of year, best of list at the end of the year. Alyssa, what are some of the best movie or TV shows you've watched so far in 2024? What's some of your favorite stuff so far this year?
I want to start by talking about a TV show, if only because I think it's a show that allows me to make a sort of larger point. The best TV show I've watched this year is Tokyo Vice, the second season of HBO's adaptation of Jake Adelstein's memoir about being an American reporter on the Yakuza beat at a Japanese daily. And you know, the thing that I think is great about Tokyo Vice, it is a perfect example of why not everything needs to run for a million seasons. It told an excellent self-contained story that wrapped up all of its plot points in two outstanding seasons. And it is a great example of sticking the landing. I think that Shogun, which until its final episode I would have said was the best thing on television, was one of the best things I watched on television all year, really handled things poorly by essentially telling you what was going to happen next, wrapping things up in a sort of very abbreviated way, killing off its most engaging main characters, and then announcing a season two renewal. It would have been a frustrating ending even had the show not been renewed, but by continuing, you know, this story beyond what had originally been a limited series, that final episode of the season really, I think, undermined the show for the season to come. Tokyo Vice, on the other hand, is this, you know, it's just perfectly, you know, it's this, calling it a jewel box of a show feels sort of silly because it's about Tokyo, which is, you know, one of the biggest metropolises in the world. And it's a show that spans a bunch of different institutions, a large newspaper, a police department, a, you know, sort of feuding Yakuza community. But at the same time, it was a show that felt, you know, attentive to detail, really beautifully lived in, had all sorts of great little character surprises, like spent two seasons sort of implying that the main character's father, like, must be kind of a, like, not a great guy because they kept pestering him to come home, you know, back to the United States. And when you finally meet him in the second season, it turns out his dad is just, like, a total mensch. You know, there is a first season episode where two of the main characters, you know, this young reporter and this young Yakuza, spend the whole night kind of driving all over Tokyo debating Backstreet Boys versus New Kids on the Block. And, you know, it is just such a remarkable combination of sort of character study, of really well-paced plotting, and sort of genuinely surprising events that all make sense within the context of the show. And it's just impeccably acted, beautifully styled. I kind of think we should all, you know, dress like people working in Tokyo in the 1990s. And go to little hole-in-the-wall ramen shops and cocktail bars and, like, maybe take up smoking cigarettes. Probably shouldn't do that, but the show makes a pretty good case for it. It was just outstanding.
Smoking makes you look cool. New evidence provides, right?
Yes.
Like, new evidence from movies.
Smoking, bad for you. It's bad for you, but good
extremely
for your,
bad for you.
Good for your vibes. No, I love Tokyo Vice. And I've mentioned this before. We've discussed a little bit. One thing, the thing I most like about that show is that it was shot entirely in Tokyo. I mean, there's an episode in Missouri, which I assume was not shot in Tokyo, but the movie was shot entirely in Tokyo and surrounding environs, which not a lot of Western shows are. For instance, Shogun, was shot in Vancouver, I believe. But, you know, difference between ancient, you know, whatever, 1500s Osaka Japan and 1990s Japan. But the it gives the whole thing a real verisimilitude that is fascinating to watch. And, you know, it makes it feel real and lived in. And yes. A lot of stuff, you know, doesn't necessarily hit that. Hey, you got anything else for us, Alyssa? What else?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of the things that I liked the most this year were entirely predictable things that I would like so far. Like, loved Dune 2, right? I mean, and not just because it's loud. I think that.
Okay, you know, but you did love that it was loud.
I deeply appreciated precisely how loud Dune 2 was. It was wonderful to see it in a very loud environment. But yeah, I mean, loved seeing Denis Villeneuve, you know, sort of update Frank Herbert's texts in some really interesting ways that, you know, give Zendaya more to do and, you know, kind of deepen that text in a way that will be interesting if they continue to make subsequent sequels. Speaking of the year of Zendaya, also just like Challengers is one of the movies I have thought about most since I saw it. Like, it's sexy, it's funny. You know, I just getting to see young actors that I really like do great stuff is just an incredible pleasure, right? I mean, I remember seeing Mike Faist in Steven Spielberg's remake of West Side Story and just being like, oh my God, there is a guy who can command the screen in a really small role. And I just, you know, he's great. Josh O'Connor's great. Like, just watching Zendaya walk angrily down a hotel hallway is a really wonderful cinematic pleasure. And I just, you know, I can't wait to see that movie again, hopefully on a big screen again. You know, I liked... I think Civil War was a movie I was frustrated with at the time, but has really, really lingered with me. And not, all right, Superman. And not for sort of the final stretch of the movie with its assault on Washington, D.C., which I continue to think is one of the weakest parts of the movie, but just for all of its little frightening vignettes, right? Like, it's like watching a great collection of upsetting short stories.
I mean, it's a road movie through that whole second act. It's frankly structured, you know, something like Huck Finn, right? It's very comparable in terms of the way it sort of doles out these like little
encounters,
connected, but not they're escalating, right? And like you're building towards something and you're learning about the characters, but it's pretty episodic. And you could I'm not suggesting that anyone do this because I think it would be a bad idea. You can imagine a much worse version of this that's like 8 hours, in which the whole middle act of that movie is just a different episode, you know, it for each episode, right?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and so I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it's really just beautiful and terrifying one. And again,
also loud.
And then, you know, this has not been sort of a great year for romantic comedy so far, but I did just really enjoy Hitman. You know, Ryan Gosling is wonderful. Emily Blunt is wonderful. Hannah Waddingham is wonderful. And
are you talking about Hitman or Fall Guy? Because
Fall Guy. My brain is broken.
We watched both Hitman and Fall Guy, and I think liked both of those movies.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's a million degrees in the attic where I tape this podcast, and sometimes my brain gets just turned into pudding. The Fall Guy. Just like I like a good romantic comedy, and that's like a pretty fun romantic comedy. Totally aside from the joy of watching Ryan Gosling do ridiculous and dangerous things with his body. I enjoyed it. It's was sort of perfect summer fluff at a time when I really needed it.
All right. Peter, what do you got on your list? Best number one thing and then a couple honorable mentions. Go.
So the best thing is Dune 2. I saw Dune 2 4 times in the movie theater in the space of 3 weeks. I don't usually do that. I think that I'm not sure when the last time I saw the same movie 4 times during an opening stretch was even The Matrix, which is the movie I've seen in the most number of times in a movie theater on a big screen. I only saw 3 times times during its opening run. Now, I did go see it three more times later that year in a second run theater because this is my freshman year in college and that was what I had money to do. But like, it's, I don't see movies four times very often. And Dune 2, I saw it the first time and I was like, crap, I am going to see that as many times as I can. Like I'm just going to make time for it. And I've watched it a couple more times since it's hit streaming. It's just everything that I want from a big budget science fiction movie. There's nothing in that movie that I think doesn't work. There's some things that may work better than others. Like there's relative like, oh, this is good and that's great. But everything in it works. Every minute of it is valuable. It's like perfectly paced, even at 2 hours and 45 minutes or so. It just speeds along without sort of rushing you through the material, just like the first one actually. And I am just entranced by that movie every single time I've seen it. It is just a masterpiece of audio visual creativity, right? Like it's every frame looks perfect, every sound is perfectly chosen. I could watch that movie a dozen more times than I probably will. I will second the recommendations for Challengers, Civil War, Hitman from Alyssa. Since she talked about them, I won't go too far, two more, except to say that Challengers in particular is a movie that has stuck with me because it's the kind of thing you just don't see in most years. I'm trying to think like this. That is a once a decade kind of movie, unless it becomes a big enough hit that somebody else tries to make something comparable. But it's not quite big enough of a hit for that to happen. It's just this kind of like, oh my gosh, how did that happen, right? And kind of movie, and I loved it. But I want to highlight three films really quick that we didn't talk about on this podcast. One is Love Lies Bleeding, which is the good lesbian noir from this year, because I didn't love the Coen brother one that we did watch, but I really liked Love Lies Bleeding. It is a gorgeous looking, weird, dark film with an especially good villain performance from Ed Harris. Late Night with the Devil is probably my favorite horror film of the year so far. It is short. It is compact. It is, I don't know if I want to say that it's genuinely scary, but it's very clever, and it has this fantastic central performance by
David Dasmalian.
By David Dasmalian as this sort of 70s late night, talk show host trying to compete with Johnny Carson and sort of be like that, except failing. And that smarmy, smug desperation that he projects is pretty amazing, especially when you consider that he makes you root for him and care about him anyway, because it's really hard to be kind of a smarmy jerk on screen and also not just fundamentally unlikable, I think. Right. And I was like, oh, this guy, right. So they do some interesting
tricks.
Feels
like you're subtweeting me right now. Yeah. I don't know.
And then the other one is one that did not make it into wide release at all, has only been touring the country. You can see it on Apple TV, and that is Hundreds of Beavers. Yes, it is actually a movie called Hundreds of Beavers, and it is about a guy who makes Applejack. So Applejack is basically old American apple brandy that has been jacked with sort of, they've mixed it down, it's a little complicated, with neutral grain spirit. And he's got to fight off all the beavers. And there's all of these men in beaver suits, but we're not supposed to treat them as guys in suits. They're just beavers. And there's animated beavers at the end. And the whole thing is structured like a video game. I mean, it is exactly explicitly Mario Brothers Zelda era video game logic about how he has to set all of his traps up and score points on a board in order to get the daughter to like win the heart of the daughter of the guy who is selling him all the stuff that he needs to kill all the beavers. It's bizarre and funny. And 15 minutes in, you're going to think, okay, this is pretty good. I have no idea how they're going to extend this to feature length. This movie should not be an hour and 40 minutes in. And there's this little bit moment between about minute 15 and 20 where you're like, this is a Looney Tunes cartoon. Is this really going to be a full, like a full length movie? What is going on here? And then you see that with each succeeding scene, they are adding a layer and another layer and another layer of complication. And somehow or another, they managed to keep this thing going for a full 100 minutes or so. And it's incredible just as a feat of low budget comic bizarre video game Looney Tunes mashup style storytelling. I would not recommend watching this movie by yourself. You need to see it with a group of friends. If you enjoy substances, find one, and maybe your substance is tea is wonderful, but like just go watch this late at night with some friends. It like be in the right mood. It is an absolute riot. One of the most interesting and most unusual films I've seen this year.
Peter, can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Do the beavers want the Applejack? Like, why is he fighting with the beavers? Or why are the beavers fighting with him?
Well, they're trying to destroy the things that he's building, and the beavers are jerks.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
It's irrelevant. The beavers are jerks.
Dune 2 and Hundreds of Beavers are two movies that both could have been an hour shorter and would have been much improved.
This is...
It's funny, you both mentioned Dune 2 as if it's like an obvious thing. I did not even consider putting Dune 2 on my list, which is kind of where my head is with that movie, which
Man,
I like.
That's so wrong,
I saw
wrong,
twice.
Sonny.
First time I liked it, I was like, yeah, this is pretty good. And second time I was like, this part in the middle in the desert goes on for a million hours and does not work at all. And also the villain performance. Everyone talks about Austin Butler, and he is so much better in The Bike Riders than he is in that movie. The whole Harkonnen, the villains in this movie do not work and do not make any sense. They do not work dramatically. It's a real problem for the film.
I disagree
with that.
Which
looks nice.
I disagree with that. It's not just nice. It looks incredible.
It looks fine.
Like it looks like what we are always demanding movies look like, which is fussed over and not kind of fundamentally fake. And like the light is interesting and right and consistent.
It looks pretty good.
So look, I'll give you Austin Butler's performance in that movie has been somewhat overpraised, and he is better in The Bike Riders. But the reason the Harkonnens work in that film is because they're essentially the orcs in Lord of the Rings, and the orcs in Lord of the Rings don't need like dramatic motivation in the way that characters do. They're bad guys. They're orcs. They're
incorrect.
Bad guys. They're Harkonnens.
Incorrect. The whole book and the whole series is based on political intrigue and stuff, and I don't buy any of the political intrigue in it. Because they're barely characters. Whatever. Dune 2 is fine. It might make my top 10, but I would be kind of surprised. All right. So Alyssa mentioned Civil War. Peter mentioned Civil War briefly. I will also just briefly mention Civil War and saying that I enjoy it. I don't really want to talk about Civil War right now, frankly. It's been a weekend.
Let's do Furiosa. So let's do Furiosa, frankly, instead.
Yeah.
Abandon hope. There is no hope.
I like Civil War a lot. If there is a better movie of this year, I'll be pleasantly surprised. But
there's already been a better
really
movie.
Great.
It was called Dune 2.
There hasn't been. None of the movies that either of you have mentioned have been better.
Challengers is a better movie.
Challengers is not a better movie. Challengers is fine. But the only movie that might have been better so far is the one I'm going to mention right now. Of course, it's The Beekeeper, which we discussed, and is now streaming on Prime Video, if you missed it in theaters. The setup, very straightforward in this movie. What if the best agent in a super-secret government agency retired, and in his retirement found peace with the help of a nice old woman, and then that old woman was scammed out of her life savings and the savings of the charity she ran, so she killed herself out of shame, and then the man went on a rampage of revenge, culminating in him climbing the rungs of American power all the way to the tippy top and laying a primal, satisfying smackdown on those in power? Beekeeper, genre work done perfectly. It just is a solidly solemn protagonist, right? He's got
Jason
this really
Statham
dastardly
forever.
Villain. Everyone can hate him because he's the worst kind of millennial scum. Hate that guy. It's a completely serviceable action. It's fine. This is not like John Wick in terms of the shootouts and stuff, but it's pretty good. It's got some clever kills. It is a very effective John Wick clone, though, in the whole, which is nice to see because we got a lot of bad ones over the last few years. We've had a lot of bad ones over the last few years. This was a very good one. Much better than Dune 2, and right up there with Civil War.
Can I make one tweak to your description there? I think it is obviously it's playing off of the John Wick fandom. People compare, like, I don't think that's an erroneous comparison, but the movie it actually seems to be more of a clone of, or the franchise, is The Equalizer. It's very straightforwardly just like Jason Statham's Equalizer, in the sense that it's the action scenes are not as elaborate, but instead they are about kill gags, right? And it's just the structure of the Equalizer is, you know, I'm living my life here, being an ordinary person, trying to, right? Like, I used to be the super agent, and then something happens, and you
gotta
forced
to do murder,
right? And then you gotta murder all the bad guys up the chain till you get to the final bad guy. Each one of them works basically the same way, and the Beekeeper is structured much more like the Equalizer films than it is like any of the John Wick films. The action also functions, is directed, is structured much more like the Equalizer films than it is like the John Wick films.
And I will say, speaking of John Wick-like films, I wish Monkey Man had been just like a little bit better. I don't think it deserves a place in a top five or even probably a top 10. But I do think that was a really promising directorial debut by Dev Patel.
Yeah, Monkey Man was another movie that could have been an hour shorter. I mean, there's like a whole hour of wheel spinning in the middle where it's like the movie literally like builds up to the revenge part. And then it's like, no, we're going to go somewhere else for an hour. And then it comes back to the exact same place to do it again. It's so frustrating to watch. It's just like, why is this happening? I don't care.
It's not an hour long, but it's like 35.
So long.
It's 35 to 40 minutes long.
It takes about 35 minutes to get to the place where he can do his revenge and pull the trigger and he doesn't. And then it takes an hour to get back there. I mean, it's wild. It's wildly misstructured. It's a
four quarter film, and the third quarter mostly does not need to be there.
I would say it's the third quarter that doesn't need to be there. Anyway, neither here nor there. I have really enjoyed the third season of The Bear. I don't know if you guys watched The Bear.
Season of The Bear is so good.
I like the third season. So a lot of people, I have gotten the sense, and a lot of people don't really like it, that they think the first two seasons are much better. I think the first season is probably a little better. I think it's better than the second one, though. I think it's better than the second season. Second season had a higher high with the Feast of the Seven Fishes episode, right? But I think as a whole, this season worked much better because the second season had the cast all spread out all over the country or all over the world, really. They were traveling around, learning craft, whatever, and like in relationships. But this was about getting everybody back together and working in a restaurant. That's what the show is about. The show is about making the restaurant work. And this season has done a much better job of that. So I like that. Peter mentioned Late Night with the Devil, which I also like, but I prefer Long Legs, which is in theaters now, is another movie about hailing Satan in a way. Just a word of warning.
Just like
on
a
that
yellow
one.
Cab in New York.
It's more of a supernatural thriller, a la like a Frailty or a Fallen, than it is a serial killer procedural like Silence of the Lambs or Manhunter. I saw a bunch of people comparing it to Silence of the Lambs and Manhunter when, the hype train was building. And I don't think that is the right comparison, really. I think it's more, this is not just a police movie. It's a supernatural thriller. You gotta know that going in. But if you can get into that vibe, I think people will enjoy it. Anyway, lots of good stuff coming in the second half of 2024. Twisters! We're going to be talking about that next week. It's going to be fun, I think. I think we're talking about Twisters next week.
That's the plan.
I should have checked the schedule before.
Surprisingly good early reviews.
Yes, good buzz on that one. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. We're going to be talking about and paying tribute to a handful of recently departed folks: Shannon Doherty, Shelley Duvall, Richard Simmons, Dr. Ruth. They all died last week. It really feels like a weird moment of, 1980s, 1990s convergence. A lot of different things happening there. So we're going to talk about that, say goodbye to some folks we enjoyed. And now on to the main event. Fly Me to the Moon, starring Scarlett Johansson as Kelly Jones, who is a shady PR person in the Mad Men mold, who is hired by a black book advisor for President Nixon named Mo Burkus, who's played by Woody Harrelson, to help sell a weary America on the space race. Kelly must convince Launch Commander Cole Davis, who's played by Channing Tatum, that her shenanigans, which include things like partnering with Omega Watches, Tang the drink, and Rice Krispies the cereal to raise some money and some awareness to get Americans back on board with the moonshot. She's got to convince him that this stuff is all worthwhile. And she must hide from Cole a dark secret that Burkus wants to create a moon landing on Earth, film it as though it's the real thing, and beam that out to the American public. To get this done, she brings her fussy, tab-drinking commercial director Lance Vespertine, who's played by Community's Jim Rash, into the the Cocoa Beach Fold sets him loose on a production. Hijinks ensue. And that is where this movie runs into trouble, I think. There's just one element too many here. There's a very good film to be made about selling the space race, right? Again, kind of like Mad Men by way of His Girl Friday, where the fast-talking Kelly has to get the straight-laced Cole to understand the importance of PR and help him convince a group of senators that the trip is worthwhile, all while the two of them fall in love with each other, right? Yeah, that's a good story. That's a fun, nice little thing. But Berkus's so-called Artemis Project, which I feel like I shouldn't have to remind people, but I guess I do have to, that this is fabricated nonsense. It's cobbled together from spare conspiratorial parts, right, that have been floating around since Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like, there was not a faked moon landing. That's not a thing. I don't understand this, except that somewhere was like, all right, what if we did Mad Men meets Capricorn 1 as an elevator pitch? And then somebody else was like, yes, that's a great idea. It's not a good idea. It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. It distracts from the actually interesting stuff about selling the space race. It injects this weird false tension that throws this nonsense monkey wrench into the relationship between Cole and Kelly. It introduces a really fake sense of cynicism that is this, you know, should be this kind of really feel-good story. I understand that selling things to people involves some level of misrepresentation nearly all the time, but the idea injected into this film midway through, and that's the other problem, structurally, they don't introduce the, like, we're gonna fake the moon landing thing until an hour into the movie. And then it makes everything go much longer. Anyway, too bonkers to be believable, didn't care for it. I really wanted to like this film. I like all the component parts. I like ScarJo. I like Tatum. They're delightful romantic leads. They have nice chemistry together. The commingling of patriotism and commerce and scientific achievement are all amusing to watch. Colin Jost showed up for a minute, and the second he did, a guy in my audience literally got up and left. He was like, fuck Colin Jost, I'm out of here. And that made me laugh. I don't know why, but that made me laugh. There's even a nice moment where Cole is allowed to discuss his religiosity in a way that comes across as neither corny nor cynical, but heartfelt. It was like a fairly rare experience in the movies. You don't see a ton of stuff like that. But it really feels like they wrote a draft of this that was straightforward, and someone was like, we need to do a fake moon landing. And then they just stuck it in. And it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. Peter, what did you make of Fly Me to the Moon?
So I totally agree that the moon landing plot grinds everything to a halt, shows up way too late, and is one major element too many. And it's the movie's biggest misstep. But I actually disagree with you that it feels like they wrote a straightforward draft of this movie and then stuck the moon landing thing in. I feel like this movie was conceived of a romantic comedy about faking the moon landing, which is a funny idea. And you've got to get the flight director involved, and you got to get the marketing person. And then for whatever reason, they got sidetracked on, oh, but this whole thing is that, why does she get brought in? It's because they need to sell the moon landing, because they did some research and they found out that, in fact, in the 1960s, it's the thing that people forget, that the public perception of the moonshot program was that it was a giant boondoggle, that the government was wasting money that it needed to spend on, you know, ordinary Americans, right? So you think of it a little like how people perceive things like foreign aid today. Actually, pretty small amounts of money when you're thinking in like the scale of the federal budget, but people get mad about it because it seems wasteful and sort of, oh, this is just a kind of political showpiece rather than something that we actually need or is that helps normal Americans directly. And so that was the perception. It feels like that then kind of overtook the movie. And this movie has such a strange and strained relationship to the politics of its era and to kind of to just thinking about like how government works and what it wants from it. And you get this real sense this movie wants to be like a defense of government is good and can do big things, but also being like, but not with Richard Nixon there, even though Richard Nixon is there and he's okay, right? Like there's this weird like, oh, I'm a bit with Scarlett Johansson's assistant from the very beginning, where the assistant is like, I'm not working for Richard Nixon. He's terrible. I'm a card-carrying feminist. They literally have a card. And then she just does. And Richard Nixon is just there and like not, right? Like, and it's just this odd thing where the movie, like, look, I know I'm the libertarian on this podcast, but I got real strong. Like, this movie wants to be about how government is good and can be wonderful and give and deliver for us. And it doesn't work in that sense, right? Like, that detracts from all the things that it should be doing. And then you get this moon landing thing that is just bizarre in this, in the context of having spent the first hour of the movie. Oh, we're basically here to convince a bunch of, congressmen or senators to fund this thing. And like, I know why the moon landing stuff gets in there. First of all, it's a funny concept. Second of all, people who make movies understand making movies and like making movies about them. And third of all, the romantic comedy conceit, like the structure of it, is that one of the characters needs to have a big secret that sort of where the other shoe drops at the end of the second act. We saw that actually in Hitman with Glenn Powell, right? Where he finally has to drop his act that he has been putting on. And it's like, oh, this whole thing falls apart, even though it had been looking like they were doing well together. In this movie, it seems like the writer, the creators felt like they needed that element in here. And it just doesn't work as much as I really like Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum. And it just ends up being a movie not actually about the space race and not actually even about government funding. It ends up being a movie that is almost entirely about on-set Hollywood type problems, even before you get to the actual making of the movie, because Scarlett Johansson's character shows up and the main thing she wants is for all of the talent, all the engineers and the flight director, right? Like all the folks working at NASA, she wants them to do PR. This is a constant problem that producers have with their talent in Hollywood. Well, we need them to do PR, right? And then the second half of the movie is like, the big problem is we've got to get the wiring right and not have people falling over on set and deal with the fact that our director is kind of a prima donna. Again, these are Hollywood problems, not engineering problems, not space problems, not even government problems. And the movie gets like at no point you actually, with the exception of maybe the prologue, at no point you actually see NASA people working on the spaceflight program solving NASA engineering problems. And it makes this movie like, what am I even watching this for?
Peter, is a libertarian, do you think we should have gone to the moon?
I think you can fund a lot of this stuff privately. And I'm glad that people stepped to the moon. Great. Go America. But you can fund a lot of this stuff privately. It's always been possible to do it for a lot less money and not use taxpayer money to do it. And in fact, if you had private funding for this stuff, you wouldn't have to do insane like rounds of convincing senators that like, oh, we got you your favorite ice cream, so they vote for us. You'll like us, right? Like you don't have to, like you take it out of the realm of politics and it's you solve a lot of those problems.
Well, it'll just be like the what's the Adam Sandler movie where he went to the moon? Spaceman? Was that it?
Where he went to the moon? The Adam Sandler movie we watched earlier this year, Oort Cloud,
or whatever that is,
where he flies around and is sad because he's got a giant spider played by Paul Dano.
That's the libertarian dream, right? Doesn't he have to go to all the? He does all the ads. Well, he does the ad reads while he's, and it's embarrassing for everyone because it should just get the money from the government to do things like that. It's fine. All right, Alyssa. Alyssa, what did you make of Fly Me to the Moon?
Man, I wanted to like this more than I did. I mean, I probably, of the three of us, was the one who most, like, wanted to like this because I like romantic comedies and I want them to be good and successful. And this one, I feel like what it is trying to do is channel sort of the spirit of Bewitched, right? Like, you have the sort of running gag with the black cat. You want the sort of... It wants to be like a little bit dippy and a little bit unreal. And I think the problem is that it's sort of pulled in these two directions, right? It's like it is a movie that wants to have a sort of cheerfully unreal vibe, even as it is a movie about the importance of the truth, right? And so, you know, there is just kind of a fundamental tension between the movie's veneer and its sort of alleged substance that really kind of undermines it. And I think, like, you could have gone in many directions about what you cut in this movie, right? Like, I actually sort of made a note to myself. I was like, what are they doing with this black cat, right? And then when you get to the end of the movie, where the Black Cat ends up playing a sort of crucial role in apparently world history, I was like, really? Did we build this entire movie around like a gag with a black cat? Which, you know, is it's entirely possible that that's what the core of the movie was and then everything else got added on.
Just endless setup.
So much setup. And I think there are a lot of sort of individual, unbelievably charming scenes in this movie. Like, I mean, watching Channing Tatum and Scarlett Johansson just like eye each other up in a Cocoa Beach coffee shop is like, you know, they're like that scene alone just has a lot of charm and promise. But yeah, it just the sort of side plot with like Ray Romano, does that guy have cancer? What's the deal here? Like the idea that like the death of Gus Grissom and his colleagues is reduced to like a kind of weird, I don't know, like recurrent ghostly footnote in the movie is sort of odd.
It's borderline offensive the way that they use the deaths of those astronauts. I mean, I'm pretty willing to just accept fiction is you get to do whatever you want and you don't have to. I don't know. Maybe not offensive, but insensitive.
It's not tasteful for sure. It is. I would say there is a real question of sort of taste there, in terms of how they deploy that, and I think that was sort of unfortunate. The clothes are great, you know. I thought the costuming in this movie was really smart, in the sense that the characters both are wearing the stuff that's very sort of appropriate to their era and in a way that reminds you that what we think of as like the 60s in terms of like hippie styles and bell bottoms and much more informal clothes on men and women is really sort of a function of the 70s. And also the fact that the characters don't have that many outfits and they wear them over and over again. So like Channing Tatum is frequently in like that yellow sweater. You know, you can see that like he wears an undershirt, which is something, again, like very appropriate to the era. Johansson's character, I've forgotten all of their names already, like wears the same dresses a lot, even though she has a slightly larger wardrobe. This combination of elements does not work. And I actually submit that you could have started even earlier and cut the Woody Harrelson character. And I really enjoy Woody Harrelson, but why on earth would you need to blackmail an advertising executive into going to work for NASA, right? Like, that's a huge potential government contract.
I mean, have you seen what GS-12's... Didn't she, like, show up and become a staffer, right? Which is weird.
Literally, as the only person on this podcast who spent 2 years of my life covering the federal HR system, I do know what GS-12s make. But come on, it's like you do that for a year and then you immediately are like the most important PR person in the world and can make a bajillion dollars. And so the fact that you have to have like the dark secret where she's a con woman that turns out to be like not that much of a dark secret after all, and that she has to be like blackmailed into this and then he also wants her to fake the moon landing, it's just unnecessarily emotionally convoluted.
And it kills all the drama with her and Cole. I find it all deeply annoying. That's the main sense I had while I was watching this. I kept finding myself getting more and more annoyed by all of the convolutions on the screen. And I'm just like, just let them be together and then like have like a naturally awkward falling out for the end of the second act and then they get back together. But this whole thing, this whole ridiculous subplot at the end where they have to like break into a store to get a color TV so they can put a friggin' transponder in the spaceship. The guy's running up the tower to like go into the spaceship moments before they take off. And I'm just like, why is all of this happening? Why is it happening? It doesn't work as it doesn't work as drama. It doesn't work as tension. It just is annoying. I was like, stop annoying me.
I agree with you on all of that, but it box checks the requirements of a romantic comedy third act with the rush to the airport and the third act complicator and all of that. And I think you could have hit those requirements and checked those boxes with material that wasn't tonally out of place in many instances or flat out ridiculous. But like to me, this looks like a bad version of structure box checking.
I'll tell you what, there's a good version of this movie that was made by the Coen brothers, and it's just about faking the moon landing. And like that's a funny movie. And I would like to watch that movie, whatever this
thing
is. But
there's also a good version of this movie made by Steven Soderbergh that doesn't have any moon landing stuff in it. It's just about the natural romance that happens between a flight director who doesn't care at all about the comms stuff because he just needs to get the engineering done, and the comms person who understands that you can't get the engineering done until we create a shield around you to like some space with public opinion that supports you doing your work. And you see over time they figure out like how to like each other for their professional competencies, right? And you see him doing some actual engineering and some actual flight directing, and you see her doing real marketing, not just showing up with, you know, magazine billboards, right? Like, and Soderbergh, who always has a great interest in Florida among other things, but also like how people do their jobs, would have made a great movie along those lines.
All right, what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Fly Me to the Moon? Peter?
Sadly, thumbs down. It's several great concepts, none of which are executed well, but I did really like Channing Tatum and Scarlett Johansson in this.
Alyssa?
Thumbs down with regret.
Thumbs down. Do less stuff next time. That's my recommendation. Do less stuff.
Is this our first universal thumbs down this year? It might be.
It might be. I don't know. I feel like we mostly try and like things on this show. We like liking things on this show, and the rare we don't. All right, that is.
We did do a bonus on Madam Web, which I guess you didn't see, Alyssa, yes. But you laughed your way to an implied thumbs down on that movie.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct.
All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that Dune 2 is, in fact, 1 hour too long. I'll see you guys on Friday.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo! Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.